Over the last 50 years, wages for regular people have increased by around 18% after inflation. In the same time, compensation for the top 0.1% of wage earners has increased by a massive 341%, leading to wider inequality over time as they can save and invest more of a bigger income. However, there is one group that puts even them to shame. The total compensation of top CEOs has increased by 1,460%. Now, if you have been paying any attention to the news, or if you could read the title of this video, that might not be a huge surprise to you anymore. But what a lot of people forget is that these people are still just employees. Most of the world's top CEOs did not found the companies they work for, and most of them don't even have huge ownership stakes in these businesses. So what the fuck do these people actually do? Why are business owners paying them better than they are paying themselves, and why are so many of them retiring all of a sudden?
Disney still had to suspend pay for 100,000 employees after its exec, Bob Iger, announced he was giving up his $3 million base salary.
CEOs really let loose in 2021. While inflation wiped away wage gains for most workers, the typical CEO paycheck grew 31% to $20 million.
Warren Buffett shocked tens of thousands of people, divulging his plans to retire as CEO of Berkshire Hathaway at the end of the year.
The real answer to what a CEO actually does is whatever they want. Within the company, they are only answerable to the board of directors, and the only power that board of directors has over them is to decide their compensation package or to fire them. The board of directors themselves are representatives of the company's shareholders, and in a lot of small companies, the biggest shareholders and the chairman of the board is also the CEO. So the board can't do anything apart from give advice and hope the CEO listens to it. That's only for small companies though. It is incredibly rare for the CEOs of public companies to have this much power. In fact, there is only one company in the S&P 500 where the CEO cannot be voted out by the board, and that's Meta's Mark Zuckerberg, since he owns a majority of a special type of share in the company. For every other CEO, their only real job is to not get fired by the board. The best way to do that is to keep the board that represents the shareholders happy by delivering strong business performance. Make Green Line go up is a simple objective, but it still doesn't answer what they actually do all day, since that goal can be achieved in so many ways. But I have to make this video before Good Work makes a funnier, better version of it. Again. So let's imagine that you wake up one day in the body of a random Fortune 500 CEO, and you need to make it through the day without being found out. Here are the things that only a CEO can do from the moment that you walk into the office until the moment you leave, probably quite late at night. The first task that only a CEO is allowed to perform in a large company is to choose the direction the company will take. As CEO, only you can decide if your company will acquire another company, introduce a new product line, focus on growth or cutting costs, open in a new country, or just keep things running exactly as they are. A good CEO should talk with the board, their employees, and occasionally outside consultants before making these decisions. As CEO, talking to these parties can alert you to risks that have been overlooked, or better opportunities to be pursued instead. As CEO, there are different ways to get this feedback. Some try to be as hands-on as possible. They will talk directly to customers, do their own sales calls, and work weekends at stores. Other CEOs decide what to do based on financial statements and the advice of senior managers that pass feedback up the corporate hierarchy. The first type of CEO normally gets more praise from being a hands-on manager that really knows their business, but both styles have pros and cons. CEOs that spend too much time performing low-level business operations can get too concerned with details. A hands-on CEO can only manage a company so large before their style of management becomes incompatible with getting the information they need to make good decisions. No matter what approach you choose to take, as CEO, you are still the only person that can decide the direction of the company. Are you going to rebrand to X.com? Are you going to remove a headphone jack from your flagship product? Are you going to pivot from selling books to selling everything? The average CEO does not make that many big decisions in a day. They often don't make that many big decisions in their entire career, but they do spend a lot of their time every day talking to people whose opinions they value. So when they do need to make decisions, they can make the best one possible. But making decisions that could change the course of an entire company's future is just the first thing that a CEO needs to do when they get to work, and the other three tasks don't get any easier. The second thing that only a CEO can do is decide how the company's money is spent. A good CEO should take advice from their chief financial officer and other staff before making decisions like taking out a loan, issuing a dividend, or making a purchase. But ultimately, only the CEO possesses the authority to spend the company's money at their discretion. Since you have woken up to find yourself as the CEO of a very large company, it would be impossible for you to make every single transaction yourself. The largest transaction made by a company was $202 billion, which was paid by the British telecommunications company Vodafone to acquire Mannesmann in the year 2000.
That is a lot of money.
If you were the CEO of these companies, this deal would need your approval. But small transactions happen thousands of times in a day in companies because staff and suppliers need to be paid and basic expenses need to be covered. A good CEO will set up a framework for spending that lends their authority to use company money to staff in positions like payroll or to normal staff members through corporate cards to cover travel or general expenses. This framework should have levels of spending that need to be approved by different levels of management. If a junior analyst needs to book flights to attend a conference, they should be able to put that on a corporate card and get the expense approved by their manager. If the manager wants to reward that analyst with a $25,000 bonus, then they should require approval from their manager and possibly an independent payroll manager. Progressively bigger spends should need approval from progressively higher levels of management.
Probably the most significant announcement of the day is that we're excited to announce that we're going to be building a gigafactory in Mexico.
A good trick to cut down on expenses that you can use as a CEO is to rewrite the expenses framework to make it harder to get approvals for spending. If it's too difficult to spend money, staff won't do it unless it's really necessary. Saving money is good, but if your company misses out on opportunities because of it, it can reduce the returns you provide to shareholders. It's the shareholders who decide if you keep your job, so getting spending frameworks right is important. You want your staff to have everything they need to do their jobs, but not too much that they waste money on unnecessary shit. As a CEO, you can delegate making this expense framework to your CFO, but you still want to sit down with them on a regular basis to make sure that people at every level of the company aren't spending too much, but also aren't being stifled by financial bureaucracy. The next thing that only a CEO can do is act as the public face of a company. As a CEO of a large company, you need to accept that you are responsible for selling the company and its operations to the public because they are your customers and investors.
Get out there on the factory floor, get out there in the stores, talk to customers, think about what would you love to have.
Top CEOs spend a lot of their time talking to the press about how their company is going to deliver strong returns to shareholders. CEOs of big companies have communications teams that schedule interviews and prepare talking points. Whether they are delivering good news or downplaying bad news, a CEO's job is to convince anybody watching that their stock is undervalued and that the products their company offers are better than the competition. Making lots of media appearances is a great career move for a CEO for two reasons. The first reason is that it does influence markets. According to research from Oxford University's Said Business School, if a new CEO presents their strategy within their first 100 days, it has an overall positive impact on stock price. If the CEO keeps their investors happy, they keep their job. The second reason that new CEOs for large companies are often hired is because they are well known by the investing public because they have appeared in media before. High-level executives often hire their own personal public relations team to get them in articles and on news segments that talk about the work they are doing because they know it's the best way to land a C-suite job at a Fortune 500 company. If you are already a CEO of a large company, you get the same advantage as an incumbent president. Just by doing your job, you are getting attention. If a new board of directors at another company already knows of you and your track record, they will be more likely to draw up a competitive offer if you ever want to switch firms. The fourth thing that only a CEO can do is a less formal responsibility, but also their most important responsibility. They dictate how the business operates every day. That might sound the same as choosing a direction for the company, but it's focused internally on staff and systems.
It's not like, you know, of course the CEO has to live the culture, has to, you know, be able to make sure the leadership team lives those values. But if you can switch on every person, every employees, every team members, own mindset to say, well, I'm not just working here, Microsoft's working for me, then you've achieved.
Some CEOs like to encourage a relaxed atmosphere where people get good results because they feel comfortable and love coming to work. Other CEOs push professionalism at all costs and demand that their staff hold themselves to the highest standards no matter what they do or they will be let go. As a CEO, you will need to decide what kind of business environment you want to create. But before you choose, you need to know that certain approaches work better in some businesses than others. I used to work in investment banking, and the assumption was that you would show up on time in a suit every day and you would work late nights and weekends until your work was done. Anything less than that, and you were going to get the tap on the shoulder. The CEOs of hospitals expect the same level of professionalism out of their staff because people's lives are literally on the line. This approach wouldn't work as well in normal companies, though, because people in these professions only put up with these extreme expectations because they are compensated extremely well. Unless you want to pay all of your staff like investment bankers or doctors, a more relaxed corporate environment is a better play, or you will have high staff turnover. Big tech companies have done the opposite. They have relaxed dress codes, and they have built offices with free cafeterias and luxury amenities to get their staff to want to work extra hours instead of demanding it. Depending on what company you wake up as the CEO of, you will need to think very carefully about what environment will get the most out of your people. But once you know this, how do CEOs actually change corporate culture? They do it by leading by example. If you want your company to be filled with staff that show up on time, do their work, and go home, you need to do the same and make sure your leadership team does the same and make sure that they are demanding the same from their teams. If you want to create a culture of geniuses fixing the world's problems with technology, you should sit in the middle of the office at a desk visible by everyone working on code in your flip-flops. If you are going to demand 80 hours a week out of your junior analysts, you should be in the office 90 hours a week. Some CEOs try to order their staff into a certain style, but staff can see hypocrisy, and if there is hypocrisy at the very top, every single manager in the company is going to have to deal with questions like, why do we need to work late when the CEO leaves at 5 every day? Why do we need to wear a suit and tie when the CEO shows up in a t-shirt? As a CEO, you will learn that it's easy to think you can do whatever you want, and nobody will say anything about it because they won't. The CEO of a company does not directly report to anybody in the company. The only people that can fire you or take disciplinary action is the board of directors, and they do not watch what the CEO does all day, but your staff does. And it's your staff that make the company work well enough to secure you another year of a multi-million dollar bonus. A report by the Harvard Business Review tracked 27 CEOs that ran companies with an average revenue of $13.1 billion. It followed them over 60,000 hours of total work, and it revealed that on average, they were working 62.5 hours per week. The study also found that 25% of their work is spent on people and relationships, 25% on functional and business unit reviews, 16% on organizations and culture, and 21% on strategy. 72% of their time was spent in meetings, and most of their communications, 61%, were handled in person. As a CEO, you are going to spend a lot of your time talking to your people, so setting the tone of the business may sound like wishy-washy HR bullshit, but it's probably the most important thing that you will do as a CEO.
There's never been actually data like this before. We've never known what CEOs actually do. And now we have some really rich data that we can dig into.
Fortune 500 CEOs consistently make headlines for making more money in a single year than most of us could hope to earn in our entire lives.
In 2020, the top 350 CEOs in the U.S. made over $24 million on average. That means at my current salary, I'd have to work over, 281 years to make what they made in 1 year.
Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, was awarded $853 million in total compensation for his work in 2021. Mr. Tim Apple wasn't even the biggest earner last year. Rivian CEO RJ Scaringe took home $2.3 billion in total compensation.
Good morning, Joe. Lots of comparisons now between Elon Musk and Rivian founder RJ Scaringe. But while Musk owns more than 20% of Tesla, RJ owns only about 1.7% of Rivian. Now, RJ is now a billionaire.
And the one and only Elon Musk was awarded more than $10 billion in Tesla options.
Stuff if you don't like it. Yeah, I mean, from the money that you sell all your stuff, you could buy new stuff.
Perhaps these two are a little more deserving, because they were the founders or very early personal investors in highly risky companies utilizing unproven technology. But most CEOs didn't take such personal risk, and many are still enjoying nine-figure salaries.
That is not my fault.
This isn't another video to complain about how unfair it is that the average Fortune 500 CEO is now earning more than 324 times the median employee at their company. We have all heard it before, and it doesn't look like it's going to change anytime soon, no matter how much the internet complains about it. Now would be a good time to remember the age-old anecdote. If you can't beat them, join them. So it's time to learn how money works to get yourself a step-by-step guide on landing a job as an egregiously overcompensated corporate fat CEO. This week's video is sponsored by Delete Me. You've probably never heard of data brokers, but they collect and sell your personal info. Everything from your home address to where you work without you ever knowing. That's where Delete Me comes in. It's a service that helps remove your personal data from hundreds of these broker sites, automatically and year-round. I signed up a few months ago after a friend found his phone number and full address listed on some sketchy site. I checked mine, and yep, same deal. DeleteMe found my info on over 40 data broker sites. They removed it, sent me a full report, and even keep checking to make sure it doesn't come back. What I really like is how hands-off it is. I don't have to track anything down myself, and their dashboard makes it super easy to see exactly what they removed. So if you want to start taking your privacy seriously, head over to joindeleteme.com/HMWU and use code HMWU at checkout to get 20% off. That's joindeleteme.com/HMWU, promo code HMWU. Of the 500 CEOs on the Fortune magazine's list, only 21 were the founders or co-founders of the companies they lead. So if you want the abbreviated step-by-step guide, then step one, start a multi-billion dollar company and don't get fired by the board or retire. Congratulations, you're now a Fortune 500 CEO. That was easy. By the time you have completed step one of this guide, you will probably already be a billionaire. So maybe the thought of a day job, however well compensated, might have lost its appeal. Anyway, 21 out of 500 is pretty bad odds. So let's go for the more involved but safer set of instructions. The remaining 479 chief executive officers got their jobs by working their way up through corporate roles, which starts with college. I know my video last week was all about thinking twice before committing to a college degree, but if you want the top job at one of these companies, a degree is mandatory. Every single non-founding CEO of a Fortune 500 company has a college degree. Out of the 21 founding CEOs, 16 of them have at least a bachelor's degree, and the remaining 5, like Mark Zuckerberg, dropped out of schools like Harvard because their businesses started taking off before they could finish their degree. I know the story of a high school dropout starting a successful company is popular, but the numbers don't lie. If you want to get to this level, you need to go to college.
Society has rules, and the first rule is you go to college. You want to have a happy and successful life? You go to college. If you want to be somebody, you go to college. If you want to fit in, you go to college.
You also need to go to a good college. Almost 10% of the list of non-founding CEOs went to just one particular school. That's right, DeVry University. Yeah, no, obviously it was Harvard. The other Ivy League schools are very well represented in this group of CEOs as well. Once you get into one of these schools, you need to pick what to study. 41% of Fortune 500 CEOs have an MBA, which is a Master's of Business Administration, so that's a solid pick. MBA programs focus on business structures, corporate governance, and the roles of executives and organizations, so it makes sense that this is the top pick. A lot of companies will actually make their senior executives complete an MBA part-time while working their regular hours. It's a grueling task on top of the regular commitments of a corporate executive, but sometimes the companies actually pay for their executives to get these degrees because of how valuable they can be. In addition to the lessons you learn about the general mechanics of running a company, the connections you can make at an Ivy League are worth the tuition costs themselves. So many powerful and influential people coming from these schools creates a self-fulfilling prophecy of more people coming from these schools because they spent their time there interacting with powerful and influential people. So if you want to be a Fortune 500 CEO, your best chance will come from getting into an Ivy League MBA program and networking like crazy while you're there. But an MBA is a master's degree. Master's degrees are postgraduate degrees, which means you need to get an undergraduate or bachelor's degree first. Picking the right degree straight out of high school might feel like a bit of a crapshoot, but Fortune 500 CEOs overwhelmingly favor one type of degree above the others. You might think this would be a business, finance, or economics degree, but you would be wrong. 97 of the 500 CEOs on this list studied engineering as an undergraduate. There is some selection bias to this. Engineering is a tough degree to get into, and unlike law or medicine, it does not have a narrow path of progression. But engineers are still a highly prized asset in the business world. Fortune 500 CEO engineers who were interviewed about their careers admitted that they chose to study engineering because it had the lowest unemployment rates and great options for career advancement. People that are thinking like that at the age of 18 are people that will go on to lead Fortune 500 companies, and people like that pick engineering.
We hire great engineers as fast as we can find them.
Engineers are trained to be good with numbers and complicated sets of information, but they are also trained to use their skills to complete projects while collaborating with other people with differing expertise. Engineers are also quite valuable to startups as early technical employees. The list of Fortune 500 companies is dominated by businesses that were once startups not very long ago, and early employees with the right skills are prime candidates for the top job once the founder steps down. The school you complete your bachelor's degree at is much less important than the school you get your MBA from. The most represented undergraduate school amongst the Fortune 500 CEOs was still Harvard, but only 3 of them went for their bachelor's degree, with the rest of the list spread out amongst more than 300 other schools. So just go to the best school you can and work on being near the top of your class, which will make step 2 a lot easier. The average age of a Fortune 500 CEO is 57. So don't worry. Once you have graduated from your engineering degree, you have plenty of time to work on your career to get yourself into a Harvard MBA. If you want to be the CEO of a big company, you have two options. Option one is to start working with promising startups. If you hitch your wagon to the next Google or Amazon, you will be a prime contender for the top job, and you would have likely picked up some stock options along the way. According to the New York Times, the average net worth of the first 2,200 Microsoft employees is over $10 million. So even if they never made CEO, they shouldn't ever need to work again. This strategy is very risky, because for every Microsoft, there are thousands of other businesses with 2,200 employees that don't grow at all, or even worse, end up going bankrupt. To increase your chances of making this strategy work, you should target a business with around 1,000 employees with good institutional backing from a private equity firm and operating in a field with a lot of room for growth. Tech, finance, healthcare, and direct-to-consumer are all good options. Once you land that first job, you gotta do the hard part, which is work like crazy, outlast the other employees, hope the company does well, and be in the right place at the right time when the founder steps back and needs a new CEO. If you want to take a more active approach at landing the top job, then you should start your career off in a more established company, preferably one with a good amount of business pedigree. Bulge bracket investment banks like Goldman and high-end management consulting firms like McKinsey should be your top pick. I'll explain why later, but the competition for graduate programs at these companies is fierce, so if you can't get in here, almost any big company will do. Your mission at this stage is to get to an executive level role as quickly as possible. Doing good work is critical to this, but it will only get you so far. You need to market yourself in every way that you can to become your own brand name in the industry. Social media, if used correctly, can be great for this. My good friend Richard over at The Plain Bagel works as an investment analyst, but he is well known outside of his firm because of his YouTube channel. Now, you don't have to take it that far, but putting yourself out there will mean that you can make it a lot easier for you to jump between jobs as you skip up the corporate ladder. Internal promotions are slow and difficult to get in most large companies. The average employee that switches employers every 2 years earns 50% more than the average employee that stays around for longer. If you do a good job of marketing yourself inside your industry, you are more likely to walk into a job interview where the recruiter already knows about you or something good you have done, which is a huge advantage over the regular schmuck with less than 500 connections on their LinkedIn profile. You can also fast-track this process. The reason working at a top investment bank or management consulting firm is a good place to start is because you can work 2 years at one of these institutions as an analyst and gain more experience than you would in a decade at a regular company. Recruiters know this, so the exit opportunities for bankers and consultants can be extremely good, and you can often score an executive level role before you are 30. The traditional route would be to go from an analyst to a team lead to a manager and then finally on to an executive, which will take a lot more time unless you get lucky with your job switching. A word of advice based on my own experience and no further research at all is that if you do want to go the investment banking or consulting route, you should avoid an exit into tech companies, even if you are an engineer by education. You should be able to land a good job with these outfits, but it will be difficult to move up because the culture of these businesses tend to look down with their soy lattes and on-tap kombucha on the old school business bros who totally don't even know how to hacky sack. A better plan is to get a job at a big company that is really boring. A boring company is going to have less young talent, which means you won't be competing against every other hotshot career-driven 30-year-old to get an executive position. Once you have worked yourself into a role where you are overseeing at least 200 other employees, it's time again to start thinking about that Harvard MBA. Personal branding is again going to play a big role in getting you into this highly coveted course. Harvard and other Ivy League schools like to brag about how many presidents, Supreme Court justices, and Fortune 500 CEOs went to their schools, and the best way for them to maintain those bragging rights is to only educate people who their admission office thinks is likely to go on to be a president, Supreme Court justice, or Fortune 500 CEO. If you can talk confidently and provide proof to an admissions officer about how you have reshaped your industry, you are a lot more likely to get in. You will also need to do the GMAT, which is a test to assess your business acumen. If you seriously want to be a Fortune 500 CEO, this is just one of many tests you would have taken in your career, so study hard and you should ace it. Once you have received your MBA from Harvard, life should be pretty good for you. The average salary of a Harvard MBA in their first year after graduation is $207,000, and that figure should be significantly higher if you go back into an industry where you already have executive experience. Your next goal is the C-suite, and to get there in a Fortune 500 company, you are going to need to double down on that personal branding. At this level, it is not unusual for individuals to hire the help of public relations consultants to arrange for them to give speeches and appear in media, so they are appealing to high-end recruiters, but also to company directors and shareholders who ultimately have the final say over who gets to be the chief executive. Top CEOs do earn a lot of money. And no, they don't work 320 times harder than the average worker, but they do have the potential to make or lose investors a lot more money than 320 regular employees ever could. Part of that is just branding. If an executive that the general public sees on the news every morning is announced as a new CEO of a company, it can boost the share price significantly. The other side of that is if somebody that nobody has ever heard of is announced, then it will raise a lot of questions about who is leading the company, even if that person is just as technically competent as the person with the PR team behind them. Even if you do absolutely everything right, you still probably have about a 1% chance at best at becoming the CEO of a Fortune 500 company. But that's okay. Even if you stray away from this exact path, you are still going to be making a lot of money and working in a very exciting role, but it will come at a huge personal cost. You have to decide if long hours for years on end are worth it for the chance to have your salary ridiculed by every congressman proposing a new tax bill. Because, oh yeah, that's right. If you do end up becoming the CEO of a public company, your income will become public record. So if you wouldn't feel comfortable putting up your paycheck on Facebook, maybe the job isn't for you after all.
After what we've seen over the past few months, I think we finally need to admit, once and for all, that these people are fucking idiots.
I screwed up. Like, I was CEO. I had a responsibility. That means that I was responsible, ultimately.
We did not catch and fix these issues faster.
Are you sincerely trying to save the world?
Well, I'm trying to do good things, yeah.
Definitely not worried about getting sued, but I'm worried about doing something for my own benefit. Like,
I know you can't talk about it.
I don't know what's not.
I regret for every single person that had to go through that. It was not my intention, not what they signed up for.
Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
The FTX bankruptcy has shed light on a lot of bad business and investing practices, both within the company and outside of it. One of the biggest issues that now seems funny in hindsight was the undue attention placed on the business's founder and CEO Sam Bankman-Fried, or SBF as he is better known amongst recently bankrupt crypto bros. In the lead up to its eventual collapse, SBF arguably got more attention than the multi-billion dollar business he ran. Unsophisticated financial commentators, all the way up to the world's largest venture capital firms, were captivated by the fact that he wore the same sneakers as their grandparents and drove a Toyota Corolla. As the FTX story unfolds, allegations are now coming into light that this geeky persona was little more than a carefully curated image, and that Bankman-Fried would go as far as to intentionally act erratic with outside investors because it furthered his image as some kind of misunderstood visionary genius. But what was, for some reason, a big selling point for SBF and his doomed companies should really be a cautionary tale for all of us. Visionaries do not make good CEOs, and to take it a step further, good CEOs should not be visionaries. It's easy to throw stones at the rubble of a bankrupt company like FTX, but celebrity CEOs have become a genuine problem that might be costing us all a lot of money, even if we don't directly invest into their companies. When we were talking about visionary CEOs whose personal image is inseparably linked with their companies, it's hard to look much further than Elon Musk. Musk is obviously a talented guy, and his mere mention of a company or a cryptocurrency can send valuation skyrocketing. But that's not a power you want your CEO to have. Investors in Musk's ventures have mostly done well for themselves up until this point, but that trend is starting to reverse. Tesla's stock price is down over 50% from its peak, which means a lot of investors in the company are now holding onto positions where they have lost money. His drawn-out acquisition of Twitter has not been going well, to say the least. By almost every educated estimate, he significantly overpaid for the platform, because the alternative was going to prison for stock manipulation. Musk used his significant stake in Tesla as collateral for the loans he needed to take out to close the $44 billion deal, which has now put downward pressure on the electric car company that had no direct involvement in Twitter outside of sharing the same visionary CEO. People find it much easier to get behind the idea of a charismatic person than they do to get behind the ideas of a big corporation, and this can be great for building hype around a company. But then, for better or worse, that company becomes linked to that person's decisions. Individuals who have only been told how smart they are for decades on end are prone to making more erratic decisions than boring, structured corporate management. The problem for investors is that by the time a CEO like Musk has crafted themselves a public image as a visionary, the stocks they represent are already overvalued, and any dumb decisions they make going forward will represent outsized downside risk to that position. If a business sells itself on having a visionary CEO, any investor in that business is putting their money behind a person as much as they are a business, and people are much less predictable than well-regulated companies. Musk's ongoing Twitter saga and some bad PR moves in the past have hurt investors in his companies, but he is a saint compared to a lot of other touted visionary CEOs. Outright fraudulent companies like FTX, Theranos, and companies really cutting close to the line like WeWork would not have been possible without charismatic figureheads distracting investors from the fact that their business makes no sense. Startup founders do need to occasionally be their own hype men to attract early investors and customers, but there is a big difference between talking about what a business can bring to a market and talking about a personal vision for changing the world. Even if businesses do not start off with fraudulent intentions, admitting failure early on is going to be much easier for a manager to do if they have not aligned their personal identity with the success of their business. There is no way of knowing for sure, but Elizabeth Holmes probably didn't set out to start a vehicle for investment fraud. She started out to build a medical technology company. When her technology didn't work, the right thing to do would have been to admit the failing and either shut down the company or try to raise more money to continue research and development. But failures and setbacks are not what you would expect of a visionary CEO like Holmes. So she took a different route that destroyed billions of dollars and landed her in prison for 11 years.
Sentencing Elizabeth Holmes of Theranos to more than a decade in prison. Remember, of course, Holmes was convicted about some business dealings related to this failed blood testing startup.
An exciting company with boring management is going to do much better long-term than a boring company with managers that are celebrities in their own right. The explosion in the number of visionary CEOs in the past 20 years is no accident. Today, CEOs of large companies will personally hire public relations consultants to polish their personal image in the media. Corporate ladder climbing CEOs try not to attract too much attention. They mostly want to make sure that a cursory Googling of their name won't say anything that could affect their chances of landing another eight-figure role. But company founders will often take this a step further. People like Holmes, Newman, Bankman-Fried, and Musk work carefully to curate an image of themselves as a genius who is simply destined for success. A fine-tuning of their public image goes beyond framing them as misunderstood geniuses as well. Bezos, Holmes, Zuckerberg, Newman, Buffett, the Waltons, and most recently, of course, SBF himself, have all had articles written about the cheap cars they use to drive. PR consultants will grant access to media outlets that are willing to report on these cars because it furthers their image as a frugal, pragmatic business owner who is more interested in changing the world than they are in surrounding themselves with luxury. These same articles conveniently exclude details like the fact that Bezos has two private jets, a dozen homes around the country, and a very expensive toy rocket hobby. And Zuckerberg owns an entire Hawaiian island. Buffett, the king of the humble persona, also owns a private jet and mostly gets driven around in a fleet of Suburbans, and Bankman-Fried may have very well driven a Corolla, but he also used hundreds of millions of dollars worth of investors' money to buy up luxury real estate all over the Bahamas for the enjoyment of himself and his fellow FTX executives. The problem this creates for businesses is that it becomes very hard to pivot away from the ideas that aren't working because it can hurt the personal brand of the visionary CEO. Whereas if the company was being led by a generic corporate suit, it is far less damaging for them to change course or simply be replaced. The biggest problem today with so-called visionary CEOs is that they normally hurt the everyday functions of the business and can ironically actually reduce how innovative the company is.
You talking to me?
A report by the Harvard Business Review titled Why Visionary Leadership Fails looked at 136 managers across various levels of the corporate hierarchy. They found that managers that could be identified as visionaries often micromanaged their staff, were prone to being overly fixated on irrelevant details, and quashed the free flow of ideas amongst their peers and subordinates. Visionary leadership was also found to create a culture of despondency in the workplace amongst workers who weren't fully aligned with their visionary CEO's vision. If workers can't contribute their own ideas towards a project, they are unlikely to put in any more effort than the bare minimum to qualify for a promotion or to simply avoid termination. Visionary managers were also shown to create the business culture for all levels of management underneath them. If a middle manager has a personal vision for how something should be done and won't accept anything different, then the managers beneath them won't be engaged and neither will the managers beneath them, and so on down to the bottom of the corporate ladder. If that visionary leader happens to have the very top job, then it can create this culture for the entire company. A lot of companies run by visionary leaders have been famously terrible places to work. Tesla and SpaceX have very high staff turnover rates compared to their industry average. Emerging stories from inside FTX are not painting a good picture, and even Apple during its era of Steve Jobs was a famously unpleasant place to work.
My camera's not turning on. What's that? I did slide it and let go. Not turning on. Here. Okay. We'll let an expert see if he can turn it on.
A CEO's job is to decide on strategic directions for a company and put the right process in place to make sure the company stays on track to achieve those results. It sounds like an easy job, but it is hard and time-consuming, and frankly, quite boring. It's much more fun to role-play Tony Stark and get directly involved in the development of whatever is going to make the next week's headlines. Companies grow by attracting and utilizing talent. Even if a visionary CEO is legitimately brilliant, they are never going to be as creative or solve big problems as effectively as a good team of qualified and motivated staff. But if visionaries really do make terrible corporate leaders, then why are there so many of them? Well, the Harvard Business Review presents a compelling answer to this question too, which is that most people that see themselves and want themselves to be seen as visionaries are more likely to start companies and have the right personality to seek early stage capital. Pure sample bias means if more people in this group of people try to start a business, more of them will be successful enough to become household names even if they have a lower starting chance of becoming successful as compared to a founder who just wants to build a solid business in an area where they see a good opportunity. Adam Neumann, the eccentric CEO of WeWork, presided over the bankruptcy of a company that was worth almost $47 billion. He was kicked out of the crumbling company he founded, but not before making $1.7 billion from a company that never figured out how to even make a single penny in profit. Dennis Muilenburg, the disgraced former CEO of Boeing, was fired from his position after his mishandling of the 737 MAX disaster that led to the death of 346 people. He walked away with a $62 million exit package, and he is now the CEO of a new aerospace investment company. Why the fuck does it seem like no matter how badly top executives fuck up, they can only fail upwards?
Of Moderna recently received a golden parachute of some $800 million.
He could walk away from the company with $60 million.
The former CEO of McDonald's could get a $70 million payout after he was fired for having a relationship with a colleague.
Heinz is in for a big golden parachute if the company gets sold, and he gets the boot. Heinz stands to get more than $55 million if he sells the struggling smartphone company.
If it seems to you like once you hit a certain level in the corporate world, it's almost impossible to fall back down, you would be kind of right. There are endless stories about CEOs that have bankrupted their companies only to be paid millions of dollars as an exit package before any of that money gets to investors, lenders, or even regular workers. The reason this happens so often is because it's designed to happen. And there are three reasons why even after these failures, most senior executives only seem to fail upwards. The first reason is corporate America's dangerous obsession with experience. You all know about companies demanding 3 years experience for an entry-level job or 10 years experience coding in a language that has only existed for 5 years. But experience is an important metric to gauge someone's ability to perform their job effectively. If you have been working as a welder for 30 years, you are probably going to weld faster and cleaner than any apprentice with a few months on the job. The same goes for everybody all the way up the corporate chain, but not by as much. The only way to gain experience as a welder is to be a welder. Likewise, the only way to gain experience as a CEO is to be a CEO. But nobody is giving out those jobs. A report by the Harvard Business Review surveyed C-suite executives and hiring boards and found that their individual technical skills have become a lot less important than the business acumen and soft leadership skills. These are not skills that normal people can acquire by climbing the corporate ladder the old-fashioned way, which is why more C-suite executives in Fortune 500 companies than ever came from backgrounds like private equity, investment banking, or corporate consulting. A survey by the workplace intelligence company OnDeck compiled a list of CEOs of America's largest companies and found that most of them worked for management consulting firms before becoming the CEOs, and very few worked their way up within a firm. 7.1% of CEOs in the report had worked at McKinsey & Company before securing a position as a CEO in another company. Bain, BCG, Kearney, and Oliver Wyman, all management consulting firms, took second, third, fourth, and fifth place. When CEOs are being selected from such a small pool of people that all know each other, then even if they fuck up royally, they are still placed above most other candidates. It doesn't make it any better when one of the most common tasks that management consulting firms get hired to consult on is who should be a new CEO. A team of McKinsey consultants picking an ex-McKinsey consultant to be the CEO of a company that hires McKinsey consultants happens all the time. This would be okay if these McKinsey clones made for the best CEOs. After all, a job should go to the most qualified candidate, but a study conducted by the Harvard Business Review found the opposite. The research looked at three metrics to rank the performance of CEOs: the total industry-adjusted shareholder returns produced, the total country-adjusted shareholder returns, and the total increase in market capitalization. The best CEOs were typically those from an engineering background with real skills in the field that their company operated in. Experience in general is overvalued by companies because a lot of valuable workplace skills haven't been around for long enough for experience to matter, which is why you have probably had to help your boss export a document as a PDF at least once in your career. But hiring a CEO is one of the biggest decisions a company will make. New CEO announcements have moved stock values up or down by double digits, so investors and the boards that represent them sometimes pick the safest option over the best option. And that's just the first reason why lousy performers with experience get opportunities that untested experts do not. If you make an honest mistake in your job, a good workplace shouldn't fire you immediately, especially if you have a track record of being a good employee. Sometimes this doesn't happen, and regular people are fired for stupid reasons. But it happens even more at the very top of the corporate totem pole. The turnover rate for Fortune 500 CEOs is about 10% every year. According to Fortune magazine, that number is on the rise, with a 12.2% turnover rate in 2023. According to the Harvard Business Review, the number one reason why CEOs leave their position is because they get fired, with over 70% of surveyed CEOs stepping down from the top job because they were told to by their board of directors. The same study found that the average tenure of a Fortune 500 CEO was less than 5 years, so there is clearly a lot less room for these men and women to make any mistakes. Now, they are paid a lot of fucking money, so their performance expectations should be higher than a regular employee. But another reason this happens so often is by design. The role of senior managers in a company is to set the overall direction and priorities of a company. Adam Neumann of WeWork clearly wanted to make his company prioritize attracting young alternative businesses that didn't ask silly questions like, how is this going to make money? Dennis Muilenburg of Boeing was famous amongst staff and investors for being the CEO that got projects off the drawing board and into the sky. When the strategies of these CEOs were not met with consequences, one of the clearest ways to signal to investors that a company is going to do things differently is to get rid of the person who is responsible for overseeing the way things are done. The CEO of Boeing was not directly responsible for programming the fly-by-wire system of the 737 MAX. And if the issue had been caught in testing, he could still be the CEO of Boeing today, but he was a clear figurehead that the board could use to signal a turnaround to the market. CEOs at this level know that they will eventually be blamed for a scandal that they didn't have direct control over, and they also know that their reputation can be worth a lot to investors, so they can negotiate very hard. If you are a senior executive and you have been offered the position of a CEO at two different companies offering a base salary of $1 million and an options package of up to $5 million, which one would you pick? One job is at a safe, stable company, and the other is with a new company with a thin balance sheet in a risky business. You should pick the safe company because you are more likely to keep your job for long enough to make that bag. This creates an incentive for the most talented CEOs to only work in the safest companies, even though their skills would be better applied to the riskier companies that need effective leadership the most. So, if that risky company really needs you as their CEO, you can pre-negotiate an exit package before you agree to work for them. If you negotiate a $20 million exit package and you raise the company's market cap by $200 million, then that's a good deal for shareholders, and at the end of the day, it is their company. A golden parachute also protects CEOs in the case their company gets acquired. If one company buys another company, then they won't need two CEOs. If a CEO is going to lose their job if an acquisition goes through, they would naturally resist it, which could result in investors missing out on a lucrative deal. If the CEO of Twitter didn't have a golden parachute, he could have made it really hard for Elon Musk to purchase the company so he could keep his own job. Instead, he made it really hard for Musk to not purchase Twitter because he was in line for a $42 million payday. Musk reportedly overpaid for Twitter by around $19 billion. So that exit package for the CEO that was doing a pretty bad job of running the company was still money well spent by the shareholders. With so much security, this creates a bit of selection bias amongst disgraced former CEOs. Apart from the ones that end up in jail for criminal conspiracy or fraud, most of them have enough financial security to be very picky with their next job. If they don't get an amazing opportunity that looks like an upwards failure, it doesn't matter, because most of them have enough money that they will never need to work again, so they don't need to take a job that would be a step down. Now, if you think CEOs and other C-suite executives have a powerful negotiating position on entering and exiting the top job, then that's nothing on what they can do whilst they are CEO. Just last week, Elon Musk stunned investors by demanding that the board of Tesla give him shares worth more than $80 billion if it wants him to develop artificial intelligence within the company. These additional shares in Tesla would bring his total ownership in the company to 25%. Musk explained his demands in a post on Twitter, or X, "I am uncomfortable growing Tesla to be a leader in AI and robotics without having roughly 25% control. Enough to be influential, but not so much that I can't be overturned." Musk went on to explain that unless his demands were met, he would prefer to develop AI programs outside of the company, which is something he actually already does with xAI, which is one of the six companies he is the head of. Musk's demands put Tesla's board and shareholders in a difficult position. The New York Times reported on this issue that the company's stock market valuation of almost $700 billion, more than twice as much as Toyota Motor, the world's largest automaker by annual car sales, is predicated in part on investors' belief that the company will lead the rest of the industry in developing cars that can drive from place to place without human intervention. Investors are also betting that advanced automation will allow Tesla to manufacture cars much more efficiently and profitably than rivals. So, if Musk publicly halts the development of AI in Tesla, the value of the company could tank, because it would be the death nail in the coffin of full self-driving and fully automated production. So, that gives investors two other options. The first option is to just give in. If the Tesla board does award Musk an additional 12% ownership stake in the company, that will dilute every other shareholder in the company by an equal 12%. That sucks for regular investors, but it could also be worse than just a 12% instant loss because future investors will be wary of buying stock in a company that could be diluted next time the CEO throws a tantrum on Twitter. The second option is to fire Musk as CEO, which is possible since he is only a minority shareholder in the company. But the value of Tesla is propped up just as much by Musk's cult of personality as it is by its technology. So if the board took the nuclear option, then shareholders could lose a lot more than 12% of their holdings. So there's a decent chance that Musk will get what he wants, because the power of an incumbent CEO makes him very hard to get rid of unless they are given a nice exit package or a better opportunity in exchange for quietly and amicably giving up their position. Musk has taken this power to the extreme, but even a regular CEO being dismissed instantly sends bad signals to the market. The average public CEO now makes nearly 400 times more than the average American, as their pay has increased by an average of 1,460% since 1978. Now, you probably already know the old joke that, no, they are not working 400 times harder than their employees. But being a CEO is still a serious commitment that normally involves making lifelong sacrifices to climb the corporate ladder or start a successful business, all while being constantly accountable to shareholders and a board of directors. The pay is good, but the work is hard. And if you want to be a CEO, you need to be on call 24/7 to put out fires, or your time at the top will be very short-lived. That's the story, anyway. So then, what the f*** is behind the massive rise in CEOs that only work part-time, if they show up to work at all?
Maximum damage reduction. This is a person saying.
Fired this morning after the company offered a private jet to its new CEO. Instead of relocating to Starbucks headquarters in Seattle, incoming CEO Brian Nicole will be commuting from his home in Newport Beach, California.
I never wanted to be an engineer. I never wanted to be a programmer. I never wanted to start a company. I had an idea and I wanted to build it. And I did whatever it took to build it.
Elon Musk is a controversial figure. But love him or hate him, the one thing that nobody has been able to take away from him is that he works incredibly hard. That was until recently, when people started to notice that the man has been playing an awful lot of Diablo 4. According to other players, he would have had to spend as much as 17 hours a day playing the game to reach the levels he has shown off in various live streams. Now, it is possible the world's richest man could have paid someone else to play video games for him, But a potential Diablo addiction aside, it did raise questions about how any mortal man could possibly be an effective chief executive at SpaceX and Tesla when he also has a full-time role at four other major companies. Even seasoned executives have to dedicate enormous amounts of their time to running just one company. The reality is that Elon Musk is far from the worst offender of a major company CEO showing up to their job less than you do. Brian Nickel is the newly appointed CEO of Starbucks. To join the company, he was offered a sign-on bonus which could be worth as much as $113 million within his first year. Now, some of that bonus was to compensate him for the stock options he will be giving up by leaving his previous job as the CEO of Chipotle. But it's still a record-breaking package, which is especially generous when you consider that the man won't even be moving to the same state as his new company's HQ. He will instead be permitted to work remotely from his current home in Newport Beach, and will be allowed to commute using the company's private jet when he has to be in the office. Oh yeah, and in case you were wondering, yes, Starbucks and its remote CEO did introduce a return-to-office mandate for all of its lesser office staff. Jack Dorsey, the former CEO of Twitter, rarely showed up to the company's offices, allegedly spending most of his time at his other company, Block. Just last month, it was announced that the new CEO of Victoria's Secret would also be allowed to work remotely so that they didn't have to move to the company's HQ in Columbus, Ohio. And yes, Victoria's Secret has also made it mandatory for everybody else to work from the office. There are tens of thousands of highly qualified candidates that would kill to be the CEO of one of these companies, so the hiring board can be picky with who they choose to hire. So then, why the f*** are these top employees allowed to work from home and dedicate their time to a second or third job when doing the same thing would get anybody else fired? Well, there are actually three reasons, and they are each more disappointing than the last. The first is that CEOs have become little more than a cheerleader for their company. Brian Nichols' offer to join Starbucks may sound obscene, but to the board of directors and current shareholders, it's so far actually been a pretty prudent investment. Since its announcement, the company's value has shot up by over $20 billion on the news, which means investors just see that his astronomical pay package has covered itself 20 times over. The new investors buying in also know that no matter how brilliant Nickel might be as a chief executive, he is not single-handedly going to be able to turn the company around or individually going to add $20 billion in valuation by himself. The actual reason why so many new investors bought in upon the announcement of the new CEO was because of what he represents. Nickel, in particular, has built a reputation of being an absolute hard-ass against unionization efforts and someone who is quite good at reinvigorating brand image. The new CEO is obviously a master at public relations as well, because if you Google his name and union, the only thing you will find is an identical article from about 20 different outlets all reporting on his announcement that he was willing to engage with workers. Whatever that means. But for investors, declining brand appeal and the union efforts are the issues facing the company, so appointing someone to do the job who has become infamous for fixing these issues is a display that the company is taking these issues seriously. A better example might be someone like Musk. He now has as much or more brand presence as the companies that he leads. A lot of his business's actual success may have very well been achieved by the engineers and level-headed executives working behind the scenes. But he is at least partially responsible for employing those people in the first place, so now he has a reputation as a serial entrepreneur that builds the businesses of the future. A very appealing pitch to investors. Even old Dorsey of Twitter, who apparently hated his job as CEO, presented an image that aligned with the company's investment pitch as an alternative communications channel that, like, democratizes information, man. This is all a relatively new phenomenon. Even 20 years ago, people didn't know big company CEOs unless they were extremely high-profile founders. Do you know who the CEO of Johnson & Johnson, Eli Lilly, or ExxonMobil is? Unless you are an industry insider or highly informed investor, probably not. But thanks to social media, new marketing techniques, and a new cultural interest in business and finance, CEOs, especially CEOs of modern consumer-facing companies, are just as much influencers for their businesses as they are someone performing executive functions day-to-day. Do you know who the CEOs of Apple, Berkshire Hathaway, Facebook, Nvidia, or Tesla is? Even if you don't care about business that much, you probably do. And that's because these men have become just as important to these companies' marketing strategy as celebrity endorsements and advertising campaigns. Now, some of these men still work incredibly hard in addition to being a spokesperson for their company. But for some of them, it's become possible to offload the boring work onto other employees and spend the rest of their time elsewhere. And for a lot of companies, that may very well be for the best. The role of the CEO has changed so much that even an otherwise competent business leader like Mark Zuckerberg has had to rethink his image as a technically proficient lizard person into something at least resembling a human. Now, it's possible that he is having a midlife crisis, but as several outlets have pointed out, it's probably much more likely that someone in his company has told him that human beings like human beings, so his business would probably be doing a lot better if he played the part. Now, getting CEOs out of the office and into the public eye as a branding tool might win over some users, investors, and potentially even some regulators. But unsurprisingly, there is one group that isn't as easy to win over. A survey conducted by the research firm International Workplace Group found that 93% of the 500 CEOs surveyed don't go into the office full-time, and instead have adopted a hybrid or exclusively work-from-home arrangement. That's compared to 64% of workers who make less than $38,000 a year who are expected to be in the office full-time. Now, this study was conducted in the UK, and there is no concrete numbers like this that could be found in America. But unfortunately, the attitudes are very similar on both sides of the pond. Unsurprisingly, this has caused a bit of a morale problem, because people are being told to go back into the office or start filing for unemployment while simultaneously watching the very public antics of their CEO. Even if they are going on podcasts, building custom Porsche minivans, traveling to remote seminars, or putting in hours at a completely different business exclusively for the good of their company's brand image, it can be hard for someone filling out TPS reports to accept the hypocrisy that they have to be in their office. Now, according to the survey, company CEOs are aware of this frustration. They just don't care. It's no secret that return-to-work mandates have been used by companies as a sneaky way to do layoffs, without having to actually publicly announce layoffs which could impact their stock price. Unfortunately for them, that's not really working, as people have seen the news and are trying to hold on to their jobs even if it means going back into the office. From a business management point of view, this can also be fine-tuned to other staff as well. High-performing staff on uncompetitive salaries can be given the option to work from home, where average or below average staff or employees that were hired with higher wages can be told the office is mandatory for them. Just this week, KPMG announced official layoffs, and they weren't even hiding it anymore when they admitted it was because not enough people were voluntarily resigning. To an absent CEO, staff being frustrated at the clear double standards is a feature and not a bug. Of course, another reason that CEOs can get away with not showing up to work is that they are only answerable to the board of directors, and if the company is doing well, most boards simply don't care. In a lot of companies, the boards are packed with people friendly to the CEO, so unless they really f*** up, they are free to offload whatever work they want. Nobody wants to be responsible for a big change for no reason. And that's probably the biggest reason why absentee CEOs have become so popular so quickly. According to data from Standard & Poor's, outside of the lead-up to the dot-com bubble in 2001, the world's biggest companies are now on average younger than they have ever been. A large share of the world's largest businesses, especially in America, were only founded a few decades ago. A huge venture capital financing has made scaling certain companies faster than ever, but that means that most of the time, the businesses get to where they are with their founders still in a leadership position. The problem is that being the founder of a rapidly scaling startup and being the CEO of a large company are two completely different jobs. Having the skills and experience to do either job is rare. Having the skills to do both is almost unheard of. The problem is that most founders want to maintain control of their company for as long as possible, even if there would be more qualified people to run it once it reaches a certain scale. In my own experience working on mergers and acquisitions deals, one of the biggest sticking points would be the role of the founders if their company was acquired, or once they lose majority control of the company in financing rounds. Getting rid of a CEO founder is difficult and often unpopular, so instead investors and often the founders themselves will appoint people to do the managerial work, while they just stick around as the face of the company as the CEO in name only. There is nothing necessarily wrong with this, although having a company linked to the personal image of its founders can be risky, especially if they aren't in the office where an eye can be kept on them. Within the last 6 months, the CEOs of Nestle, Boeing, Starbucks, Peloton, Paramount, Zillow, Amazon Web Services, Snowflake, Hertz, HSBC, Grayscale, Under Armour, Papa John's, and Discover have all stepped down, voluntary or otherwise, from the top job. Collectively, these CEOs controlled companies with trillions of dollars in annual revenue, and now they are all gone. These were just the big names too. CEO turnover in companies of all sizes is now higher than it has been since the start of the pandemic, which begs the question, why is this happening? And why is it happening now?
The CEO's going after 2 years, another headcount reduction.
YouTube chief Susan Wojcicki, she is stepping down. She announced so in a blog post. And
Starbucks' CEO Lakshman Narasimhan is now stepping down as CEO and director. That is effective immediately. The company has named Chipotle CEO.
Chief executives and other C-suite executives are just employees like any other, which means eventually they either quit, get fired, or die in their jobs. CEO layoffs have spiked. But maybe that's not too surprising considering layoffs in a lot of industries have also spiked. But this is actually not normally how it goes. If you ever find yourself in the top job at a major company, you should know that your position is simultaneously far more secure and far more fickle than the average rank and file employee working under you. As a CEO, your position is unique because there is no other employee at the company with the authority to fire you. The only people that can do that are the board of directors, who themselves are representatives of the shareholders. During periods of uncertainty, the last thing that companies want to do is switch up senior leadership unexpectedly, because that signals to the market that something is not right, which could tank the stock price. Since the board of directors represent shareholders, and individual directors usually are major shareholders themselves, they have an incentive to avoid doing anything that could hurt the stock price unnecessarily. For this reason, CEOs are rarely fired outright, and are instead offered generous exit packages to step down amicably in a way that won't scare investors in the business. Outside of high-profile cases where the business has clearly been mismanaged, or in cases where the CEO has made very unpopular decisions, it can be hard to tell if outgoing CEOs have been pushed out or are simply retiring. According to Fortune magazine itself, the average age of a Fortune 500 CEO is 57 years old, and the average compensation package was $16.3 million. If you are that old and have that much money, it's not unthinkable that you would want to retire or pursue less intense roles more suited to your old age, like political office. But if CEO exits are treated so seriously and secretively, why has there been such a big spike all of a sudden? Well, the first reason is that right now is a convenient time for a shakeup. Companies and their leadership don't always have completely aligned incentives. A CEO wants to make as much money as possible while in the role, and the business wants to maximize returns to its shareholders. While these incentives can be aligned through bonus packages tied to stock performance, this has made a lot of company leaders hyperfixated on quarterly financials and the stock price on the day their bonus is calculated. Stocks in most large public companies have actually been trading relatively flat. Total stock market performance has been massively bolstered by Microsoft, Google's parent company Alphabet, Nvidia, and Apple, to a lesser extent. Most other public companies have been trading relatively flat, which isn't a problem during uncertain times like the pandemic and its recovery. But investors are now starting to expect more out of their businesses, and specifically their CEOs during a drawn-out period of slow growth. Former CEO of Starbucks, Lakshman Narasimhan, was pushed out after spending just over a year in the top job. While he officially stepped down, it was clear that the company performance was bad, and he was forced out by the board after sluggish earnings reports were released. He was replaced by Brian Niccol, the CEO of Chipotle, a brand which, by comparison, has been doing extremely well. This one move replaced the CEOs of two companies, and the decision was largely pushed through by activist investors like Elliott Management, who, according to CNBC, purchased a large stake in the company in mid-July. This firm and others like it buy up large stakes in companies that are not doing too well and try to enact changes to turn the company around. This can be as simple as suggestions like offering new products, but it's usually more focused on cutting unnecessary expenses and shaking up leadership to generate the highest possible return in the shortest possible time. This particular type of investing strategy is extremely attractive in stagnant markets where it's harder to generate strong returns by just buying something and passively waiting for it to be worth more. This has already worked for Elliott Management. After the announcement of the new CEO, the company's stock jumped by a massive 24%, fully recovering its losses from its poor earnings report. If the investment firm cashed out on their position now, they would have already outperformed expected annual returns in a little over a month. Starbucks is a high-profile example, but activist investors across the country and the rest of the world are looking for similar opportunities. So many CEOs in stagnant companies are taking it upon themselves to bow out before they are forced out. Now, if you are not a CEO, you might not be too worried about the games that the company directors play with finance bros and their appointed CEOs. The CEOs that did well during a stable upmarket are not the same kind of CEOs that businesses are going to want when sales are flat. If businesses can't grow revenue, the only option they have left to increase their profit is to cut their expenses. Of course, they could be happy with consistent, predictable returns. But let's be real, that just makes them an even bigger target for activist investors looking for their next company to turn around. Now, this isn't always bad. Established companies often do pick up a lot of dead weight over the years from underperforming product lines to bloated middle management. It's normally much easier to add something to the business than it is to take it away. Activist investors may be a nightmare for existing CEOs, but they can genuinely help to save businesses that are collapsing under their own weight by putting a subjective set of eyes on the business and its operations. The only problem, if a new CEO is hired with the objective to cut costs, they are going to cut costs no matter what. And that's the second reason behind the current CEO purge. Brian Nichol, the new CEO of Starbucks, made investors so excited that the stock jumped 23% upon his announcement. He is clearly a competent company leader. Before services, Starbucks is paying him $130 million in his first year alone, according to Yahoo Finance and company filings. If the name of the game was to cut down on expenses wherever possible, that is an interesting place to start. The real reason that investors are so excited about this new CEO is that he also isn't meant to be in the top job for long. Nichol has a long history of being extremely heavy-handed with cost-cutting measures, which have admittedly included streamlining the operations of Chipotle in his last job. But it also meant coming down hard on employee benefits, cutting down on staffing, closing underperforming stores, and pushing back hard against unionization efforts from staff trying to collectively push back against these cuts. Starbucks is currently dealing with its own unionization efforts, and the part of this new CEO's job that the company won't talk about in their press release is to shut this shit down like he did at Chipotle. The company isn't expecting to pay him hundreds of millions of dollars for more than a few years. They are just hoping to pay him long enough to fix their problems before he moves on to another company that will pay him a huge signing bonus, and then Starbucks can replace him with a longer-term CEO that is only paid a modest salary measured in the mere tens of millions. These people are unofficially called turnaround CEOs, because their job is to turn a company around and then get out as quickly as possible, and their bonus structures are normally written to pay them a lot of money for quick results. Of course, the company will never publicly admit this plan, so that prediction is based off my experience with other companies employing turnaround management. Although, if for some reason you are watching this video 5 years after it's posted and Nichol is still the top dog at Starbucks, feel free to leave a comment telling me how stupid I am. Anyway, these short-term CEOs inherently increase turnover rates as they jump between companies providing their services, and turnaround CEOs are more popular with investors in markets where it's harder to find value. Now, the final reason that CEOs are quitting in record numbers is the simplest reason, which is that they really don't need to work anymore. The average CEO is older now than they have ever been before, and a lot of them just want to retire. But during the pandemic, their companies tried to hold on to them to maintain corporate stability. According to the corporate law firm Challenger Gray, Q1 2024 had the highest number of CEO resignations since they started keeping records. The number one reason that CEOs gave for leaving was to retire given how much they were paid during the pandemic and the strong market returns of their investments over that period. The modern CEO is also expected to be more tech-savvy and public-facing, prompting many of the old guard to make an exit before their marketing team orders them to do a TikTok dance.